Well, then our case for argument is Vail versus Avila. Mr. Comey.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Comey, and I represent the appellant, and it's a pleasure to be here. I was sworn in here 32 years ago, October, by Luther Schweigert and Tom Strube, and this is the first time I can ever remember being here in the summer, so thank you for giving up your summer pleasures to hear our case. My son is sitting here seeking asylum from an American girl on Michigan Avenue, where his mother has taken his sister, and he seeks the asylum of this court for this morning to protect him from the venue at American Girl. Turning to the case, we've been blessed also with law students from, I believe, Loyola Law School who are here to join us today. So I'm not used to having such a full house when I argue before you, but turning to the case, the key to this case, I think, is jurisdiction. And another concept in the case is access versus custody, and, of course, 60B. There is no jurisprudence in the country on a Hague Convention case coming to the Court of Appeals when it comes to the Court of Appeals on 60B motions. There's no place else you can look to find a preceding case that discusses the Hague directly itself. But there is plenty of law with respect to 60B motions, dismissals with prejudice that you can look to. But this case traveled out of the federal courthouse where all rights were released and settled and into the state courthouse.
Well, but when the settlement agreement reached, it doesn't look like anybody really, or at least one side, your side, didn't think it was going to happen, right?
Excuse me?
You entered into a settlement agreement in which your client said she would provide the children an opportunity to go to Venezuela. Did that happen?
It was in progress. The opportunity that was provided under the agreement provided for them to meet their father in Miami. Our clients paid for the trip to Miami for the father. The father met with the children in Miami. That occurred on several occasions. That portion of the agreement was fully funded. The coming back to federal court occurred simultaneously with the immigration authorities granting permanent residence to the children, which then allowed them to travel more fully, because at that particular point in time, they were allowed access back into the United States and could not be denied access into the country. And that was a very important feature of the agreement, because no court could have illegal children living here or countenance children living here illegally. And one of the reasons we went to the state court was to make sure that they were properly in the country, subject to immigration.
How does a state court proceeding prevent a federal court from exercising its authority under Rule 60?
Well, first of all, the federal court...
rules, equivalent of a statute, supremacy clause makes federal law supreme, so...
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First reason is that when the father's dismissal occurred in federal court, the state court retained jurisdiction to all matters under its judgment. There was a Hague determination...
Competing jurisdiction, federal and state, the federal court might abstain in favor of the state, but wouldn't be required to.
Yes, it's required to because of principles that have existed since the first adoption of the Constitution.
What principles?
Principles of recognizing that we have 50 sovereign states.
No, but look, very often you have parallel cases proceeding in state and federal court. And then the federal court may decide to abstain in favor of the state court. And it could be an abuse of discretion to refuse to do so. But there's no rule of law which says that a federal court loses jurisdiction because a parallel state suit has been filed.
Right, but the courts over the years have respected each other and developed procedures to respect
each
other.
Yes, but that's called abstention. You weigh the considerations here. And, you know, if a strong argument is made that a federal judgment was fraudulent and the federal judge wants to consider it under Rule 60B, there's nothing in... There's no rule anywhere, I don't think, which says that he can't do that.
Well, I believe that the respect for the state court is one rule. The second rule that's out there is Rooker-Feldman, because the Supreme Court recognizes it's the only court that sits over the state court.
But it's not reviewing the state court decision. It's reopening a federal case, which you can always do under Rule 60.
Well, it is, because it decided the habitual residence to be different than the state court decision. The state court decision decided that the habitual residence was Peoria, Illinois.
That's within the judgment of the state court.
Well, you know, this case started in federal court, and it was dismissed at your motion, I guess, with prejudice when the agreement said without prejudice, right?
It was dismissed on motion of the other side, Your Honor. And then we appeared before Judge McDade after we had entered the judgments in the state court.
And dismissed the federal case. Prejudice, right?
That was ultimately the judge's decision, yes.
Well, but didn't your agreement say without prejudice?
Yes, it did.
So you have a case that the trial judge, federal trial judge, thought was fraudulently produced, that is, the dismissal, and he reinstated the prior case. The case originated in federal court. Why doesn't federal court retain jurisdiction, notwithstanding whatever happened in state court?
He declined to.
He didn't decline when he came back, when he came back to him.
No, but he declined to at the dismissal. I suggested to him that he retain jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement, and he declined to.
Yes, but it's one thing to retain jurisdiction to enforce an agreement. It's another thing simply to have retained, one has always retained, one's Rule 60B powers. I don't know. I don't think a judge can give it away. I think a judge can say, I'm dismissing this suit, and by the way, don't ever come back to me under Rule 60B. I don't care whether this dismissal is procured by fraud or what. You know, I'm through.
If you want to get into the question of the fraud, you have to look at the original judgment that was entered in the state court. The modified judgment said that there were no representations made by anyone other than the parties on its face. It said there had been no promises by any third party.
There's a difference between whether there was fraud and your proposition, which is that once there was a judgment in the state court, you can't reopen the federal judgment for any reason at all. That's your position, isn't it? And you say this since the earliest days of the Republic, but do you have a case that says that or a statute?
Well, the Hague has only been around for...
That's not a Hague issue. The issue is, and it's an interesting issue, can a federal court reopen a decision under Rule 60B, set aside a judgment of dismissal, even though a parallel case is pending in the state court, or there's even been a state court judgment? That's your proposition. I don't see any basis for that. Maybe you have something.
Well, if we take the...
What's your basis for that?
By the way, Senator Dixon, who was of the law firm that's opposite us today, Senator Dixon was the one who put into the ICARA, the statute that enacted the Hague Convention into action in the country. In ICARA, he put in the fact that the state court would have concurrent jurisdiction. He was the author of the amendment.
That's true, but concurrent jurisdiction doesn't mean that the federal case has to yield to the state. That's not what concurrent means.
Well, it does at the moment it goes to judgment. It doesn't have to yield until you hit a judgment, but once you hit the judgment stone, that's a large break in what had happened before. Once you go into that judgment, and in this particular case, you enroll the Venezuelan decree to make it a state court judgment of Illinois. So the Venezuelan decree is now a judgment of Illinois. The state court modifies that judgment to recognize the shared intent of the parties that the children are residents of Peoria, Illinois. Now they are in there. They're deciding two Hague issues. Hague issue number one is, what is the habitual residence of the child? There's no precedent in Illinois law for habitual residence. You can look at the Domestic Relations Code of Illinois, and you will not find habitual residence mentioned in there one paragraph, one page, one sentence, anywhere, one word. Habitual residence is a unique creature of the Hague Convention and cannot be found anywhere else in the jurisprudence of the country. So then if we look at the fact...
Well, what's the implication of that?
Well, both under the statute of the first Congress on full faith and credit, as well as the statute in ICRA enacting the Hague, under both circumstances, that state court determined the habitual residence of the children after July. In one instance, if they were to come back to court, after July, after the judgment had been entered, would be Peoria, Illinois. Now, the district court, when we go back there, is determining the residence to be Venezuela. It's not giving full faith and credit to the determination of the state court.
Well, what about the provision in the agreement that said they could refile their Hague Convention complaint?
Exactly. Refile. That doesn't mean reopen.
Well, you know, Judge McDade made the finding that there was no intent on the part of your client to actually honor that settlement agreement. It was fraud in district court, and that's why he reopened it.
We disagree completely.
Well, I know you disagree with that, but that's a finding that you're going to have to overcome.
Well, but that's if you get beyond the question of whether or not he had to give full faith and credit to habitual residents, because if we look at the convention, you know...
But that agreement was that part of the agreement in state court?
That was part of the judgment of the state court. That's a finding of the state court, in fact.
All right. What did you submit? You submitted a joint request for an order or finding in the state court?
We made a motion to enroll the divorce decree. The divorce decree became a foreign judgment that became an Illinois judgment. Once it became an Illinois judgment, a modification judgment was made. But the judge and his findings and the signed order by the judge, separate and apart from the modification, finds the place to be Peoria, Illinois, that is the residence of these children habitually. Once you have that, you have a Hague determination. In addition to that, you have decisions in that judgment about the interplay between Articles 3, 5, and 12 about the one-year rule. Because the one-year rule is once a child becomes settled in the environment the child's in, there isn't a return. Now, in this particular case, we extended...
The agreement said that the parties agree that if the mother fails to comply with the terms of this agreement, the father can refile a Hague petition, either state or federal court.
There's missing another sentence.
The return of any of the children. Now,
there's a sentence missing from what you're reading. You're reading from the appellee's brief, I think, if it's read. So the bottom line is you're missing the next sentence, prior to July...
There's three sentences here, yeah. What is this about the statute of limitations, yeah.
Okay, the next sentence that follows says that prior to July of that year, that she waives her claims under the one-year rule. So if you look at the reply brief, you'll see that the full portion of that judgment is set out, that she waived any claim because we extended the one-year period to July of that year to make sure that she was complying. That was something that was negotiated and requested by the...
She agrees to waive any statute of limitations.
If we look at...
Look, what about the first sentence? Forgetting the second sentence, the first sentence would allow the father to refile this federal court proceeding. Now, is that valid, or does that somehow violate the full faith and credit clause?
The theory behind that was, or the purpose behind that was, in the event that these children were hung up at some other point in the future, we were looking to the future at that time, that we could come back to court, either side, and enforce the rights pursuant to the convention, either in Venezuela or here.
It doesn't say either side. It says the father can refile.
I understand, but that was the discussion that led to that. Because we had the problem of what happens if the children go to Venezuela and they're not returned.
The father can refile the suit. Surely he can ask the court to reopen the existing, the preceding suit.
Well, that's for you to determine. I suggest refile is different than reopen.
What sense would it make to say that he can refile a suit, he can file a new suit, but he can't proceed under 60B. Well, what sense would that make?
In conjunction with the second sentence.
What sense would that make? Forget the second sentence for a moment.
I can't, because they go together. It's the two.
I don't understand how the second sentence has anything to do with jurisdiction.
Because
your argument is about jurisdiction.
It contemplates...
Look, if there were no second sentence, would that first sentence be valid to allow a refiling in state or federal court?
Yes.
Then how does the second sentence affect jurisdiction?
Because it changes the presumption as to habitual residence.
What does that have to do with jurisdiction?
Because if the habitual residence is the United States...
What does that have to do with jurisdiction? Jurisdiction is a matter... Don't interrupt me. Jurisdiction is a matter of, can a federal court, after there's been this state judgment, can the federal court nevertheless, you know, reopen its suit or entertain a refiled suit? Now, this second sentence, which is about the statute of limitations and about when habitual residence shall be determined, that is prior to the children's removal, prior to March 2006, that doesn't say anything about jurisdiction.
One of the cases cited by one of the circuits says that when the child
what
moves to another country...
What does this say about jurisdiction?
When the child moves to the United States, the court no longer has jurisdiction. One of the circuit courts
That's
is held...
what this sentence is about. This sentence doesn't say anything about that.
My understanding is that the circuits have held
that if the child moves to the United States and it becomes his habitual residence, there is no longer jurisdiction in the federal court to adjudicate a Hague case.
It has nothing to do with the second sentence of this agreement. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Comey. So we'll hear from Mr. Marshall.
May it please the court, Lee Marshall on behalf of the father. Mr. Comey was unable to answer the question of what authority there is for a federal court to reopen a case due to a judgment due to an intervening state court case. And I think that failure is really dispositive of this matter. We're here because the mother committed two forms of fraud. First, the fraud in obtaining permission to bring the children to the United States. Second, the fraud to induce Mr. Valle to enter into the settlement agreement and have the case dismissed with prejudice. They have not appealed either of those determinations in this action, in this appeal. Now, I think what is really important for the court to pay attention to is Article 17 of the Convention, which talks about the possibility of a state court custody judgment and its effect on a Hague action. And in Article 17, the Hague Convention says that the sole fact that a decision relating to custody has been given in or is entitled to recognition in the requested state shall not be a ground for refusing to return a child under the Convention. And the official reporter of the Hague Convention, Ms. Perez Vera, recognized that Article 17 was directed to decisions obtained subsequent to removal, quote, which will in the majority of cases be vitiated by fraud. That's exactly the type of circumstance we're talking about here. An intervening state court custody judgment obtained by fraud that should have no effect whatsoever on the Hague action.
Did your client oppose the Illinois custody suit? Was it ex parte or what was it?
No, the Illinois custody judgment was a result of the fraudulently obtained settlement agreement.
No, but I mean, was it contested or what? Was it adversary?
No, it was not adversarial because it was the result of the agreement, which
parties had reached an agreement before you appeared before the court.
That's exactly right. It was merely to enroll that settlement agreement that the Illinois state court action was opened. The Hague action, of course, is not about a custody determination.
If the agreement had been valid, if she had complied with the agreement, then that state court judgment would be enforced, would it?
Well, if she had complied with the agreement, then there would have been no need to reopen the Hague action and seek the return of the children.
So then the children would have remained in the United States. Is that?
Well, the agreement was for the children to be in the United States during the school year.
No, I understand. But so they would have remained at least part-time in the United States.
Right. It was, in essence, a joint international custody agreement.
What if there had been a change in the status? No fraud. There's agreement to have this joint custody. But there's a subsequent disagreement in the future. Would that have entitled you to go to federal court? I'm not talking about fraud. I'm just talking about a disagreement on custody, which is common in custody situations, is it not, where parties want to alter it down the road? Don't they? Those custody agreements usually have a sort of an open-ended aspect to them.
I think if the parties had agreed without any type of fraud, and then there's a disagreement
down the road, would you be able to go in a federal court under 60B?
Well, I think that would be very difficult to do. I mean, the entire basis of our Rule 60B motion was the fraud.
My question is more aimed toward jurisdiction. I appreciate it. My hypothetical has no fraud connected to it. It just has the subsequent seeking a modification of a state court custody agreement.
Right. I think that we would probably be I think we'd probably be limited to state court in those circumstances, because the Hague action is to determine which countries' tribunals have the authority to determine custody. And if the parties voluntarily enter into an agreement in the state court that this state court should determine custody, then I think that there, at the very least, there would be some kind of waiver argument in a Hague action. But we certainly don't have that here, where you've got a fraudulently obtained agreement to proceed in state court, which was found by clear and convincing evidence and which was not appealed in this case. The whole idea of the Hague is to simply make the procedural determination as to which country's tribunal should make the decision. The full faith and credit provision of ICARA is entirely consistent with that. It doesn't say that you have to give full faith and credit to every determination a state court judgment makes. You only have to give full faith and credit to a order denying or returning the children. You only have to give full faith and credit to a determination on the merits of a Hague action. We don't have that here. We merely have a state court custody judgment, which has no effect whatsoever. Now, as to this argument about habitual residence, and that was somehow entitled to full faith and credit in the Hague action, it wasn't for a number of reasons. Number one, because full faith and credit does not apply to that, as I just said, based on the provision of ICARA, but also because the agreement as to habitual residence in the agreement was something looking forward. Once this agreement is enrolled in the courts of Illinois and Venezuela, in which it was never actually enrolled in Venezuela, but once it was, then the children's habitual residence would be Illinois. The determination before the district court judge as to habitual residence was a backwards-looking determination. The issue was, what was the children's habitual residence at the time they were wrongfully removed from Venezuela? The two things have absolutely nothing to do with each other. They're not entitled to full faith and credit. And as you've recognized, the provision allowing the father to refile his Hague action certainly allowed him to come back into court on Rule 60B. In fact, if you look at the heading of that paragraph of the agreement, it says resumption of Hague proceedings, and then it talks about refiling. So clearly there was an intent for resuming or refiling a Hague provision. And I can direct the court's attention to A406. It's paragraph 32 of the agreement, and it says resumption of Hague proceedings.
There's no contest, or is there, as far as I could tell, that the children were removed by deception from Venezuela?
No. In fact, the mother admitted on the stand that she lied to the father to obtain the permission to bring the children to the United States, that she told the father that she was bringing the children to the United States for a limited period of time so that they could attend the wedding of their grandmother. In fact, it was the wedding of the mother that they were to attend and never to be returned to Venezuela. The permission that the father signed based on that misrepresentation was only a permission to take the children out of the country for, I believe, a period of 6 to 8 days. So it was a limited permission, and it was expressly based on that representation. That was not at issue below, and in fact it was not raised on appeal either.
How did she and her children obtain U.S. citizenship? Was that because of her remarriage to an American? Or?
I would assume that her citizenship was obtained. Well, I'm not sure that she has citizenship versus permanent legal residence.
So the kids also, they're
lawful
residents.
I believe they are currently lawful residents, yes. That's not an issue. I think they have their green cards, but not citizens at this point.
But at the time they had the green card, did the appellant indicate to your client that they did not have that ability?
That's correct, Your Honor. That was one of many misstatements that were made by the mother.
So she used that as an excuse for them not to be able to travel to Venezuela.
That's correct. As to Rooker-Feldman, Both the Eighth and the Ninth Circuits have held that it does not apply at all in these circumstances, given the express grant of jurisdiction by Congress. I think the ExxonMobil case made it very clear that Rooker-Feldman is basically a statutory creation based on the Congress's grant of exclusive jurisdiction of the Supreme Court to review state court judgments, where you have an express grant of jurisdiction such as we have here under 11603. Rooker-Feldman simply does not come into play, and I would cite the court to the Moses and the Silverman case for that proposition. But also, as the court's already recognized, there was no review or rejection of the state court judgment needed here that would trigger Rooker-Feldman review or a Rooker-Feldman problem. Similarly, no abstention problem. In fact, I'm not aware of them actually asking for any sort of abstention under Colorado River below, which I think would be the only doctrine that you could even argue would come close. So I think it would be difficult to argue that the district court abused its discretion in not abstaining when it wasn't asked to under that doctrine. As far as the merits of the Hague action, they've raised a number of issues with respect to whether or not the father had custody rights in Venezuela. And I will briefly address that. Article 5 of the Convention defines a right of custody as including rights relating to the care of the person of the child and right to determine the child's place of residence. You only need a single custody right to come within the Hague Convention. And the patria potestas under Venezuelan law is expressly defined as all duties and rights of the parents in relationship to their children regarding the care, development, and education of their children. Clearly mirrors the definition of custody rights in the Hague Convention. In fact, when the mother signed the state court custody agreement, that agreement said, quote, the parents shall have joint legal custody of the minor children, also known as patria potestas under Venezuelan law. So for them to argue now that patria potestas is not a custody right, when they in fact admitted in the agreement that it was equivalent to joint legal custody, I think is disingenuous.
Mr. Marshall, exactly what is the basis of the fraud here? What's your understanding of what you believe was fraudulent here? I'm not talking about the initial statement of why the children were coming.
With respect to the fraud and the inducement to enter into the settlement agreement, the district court found by clear and convincing evidence that the mother had misrepresented her ability and intention to comply with the agreement.
And that finding is based on what evidence before the district court?
That finding was based upon the testimony of the father, as well as the cross-examination.
The natural father?
Yes.
About the ability of the mother to finance the trial?
Regarding what representations were made to him by the mother and her current husband regarding the ability to comply with the provisions of the agreement in terms of sending the children down to Venezuela.
Well, did that finding, was that rested on capacity or on some fraudulent representation? I just want to understand what the basis of the finding is by the district judge.
The district court judge found that she misrepresented both her ability and intent to comply with it. So I think it goes both to capacity to comply.
That's because specific provisions of the initial agreement were not met by a date certain, or what?
It was because she had no job. She, in fact, sent my co-counsel a letter, which this is really what triggered us filing the Rule 60B motion. She sent us a letter saying that she had no money, came to the United States with nothing but the clothes on her back, and simply couldn't meet her obligations. Those admissions were directly contrary to the representation.
Was she seeking relief in that letter from some of the strictures of the agreement? What was the purpose?
I think she was attempting to explain her failures to comply, and she was simply saying that I think that it was in essence impossible for her to comply.
So no thought was given to going to state court at that point to say that there's a failure to comply as opposed to a fraud in the inducement?
Well, based on the initial failures to comply, we did file a motion to show cause in the state court. But once we received the letter, which said, basically, I have no ability to comply, I came to the United States with nothing, at that point, we determined, and the district court agreed, that basically we had been hoodwinked in entering the settlement agreement.
Had you asked for some sort of, in entering into this agreement originally, some sort of representation of, as to capacity? I mean, obviously the agreement was signed with the understanding that the children would go back for a certain time period, but was there any what was the basis of the entering into that agreement?
Well, I don't believe that there were any express representations of warranties
assumed,
made.
It was just assumed that the financial capacity of the mother was there? Is that it?
Well, part of it was that she was now married to an individual who makes approximately $100,000 to $150,000 a year. Mr. Gracci was also at these settlement meetings and also represented, and the district court found that he represented that he would help meet the obligations.
So the district court, in effect, found a failure to meet those conditions?
Well, certainly the district court found that there was a failure to meet the obligations, but the district court went well beyond that.
That's my point.
Yeah. Yes.
And he went beyond it based on what? What was the leap from the failure to the fraud? What was the basis for the leap from the failure to the fraud?
Right. It was based on the representations that were made at the time that the agreement was being negotiated and the complete inability and inability on her part, and I suppose no intention to comply with the agreement on either of their parts. And the district court clearly made those findings based on the testimony as to what happened during the settlement negotiations, based on the exchange of emails at the time, based on the letter that she sent subsequent to the failures to comply, clearly indicating that she never had the ability to comply.
Well, she also lied about status of the children and their inability because of that not to go to Venezuela, right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. I mean, we're really talking about a series of lies from the point she takes them out of Venezuela through the negotiation, through the period where she's supposed to be complying with the agreement. It's been one lie after another.
That credibility determination, Judge McDade.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. The judge made a determination that respondent was not credible in the case. As I understand it, those types of determinations are virtually unreviewable. I see my time is up.
Can I just ask you, is this a pro bono project? Because your client doesn't have any money, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We have been representing the father on a pro bono basis.
That's just curious.
The one other request I would make of the court, other than to affirm, is to immediately dissolve the stay of the return order.
The stay is, in effect, yeah.
Yeah, the father is in the country now. In fact, he's in the courtroom. He would like to have his children returned as soon as possible to Venezuela. The district court's order required them to be returned by June 2nd, I believe. We're now past that day. So if the court agrees with our position, we'd ask the court to immediately lift the stay and allow Judge McDade to reset a return date as soon as possible.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Marshall.
Thank you.
And Mr. Comey, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute or two. Do you have anything further?
Thank you for that courtesy. Judge Flom, answer to your question is that they were engaged in post-decree activity in the state court before they filed to reopen in the federal court. There was a petition for rule to show cause filed by the father. The mother had a rule to show cause for non-payment of child support for 9 or 10 months that was pending before the judge in Peoria. And in addition to that, there was the question of the attempt to satisfy the judgment. There was a check sent to Brian Cave for the costs ordered by the judgment. They refused to cash the check and return the satisfaction without signing it. under Illinois law, you have no right to refuse a properly calculated judgment payment plus interest. The judgment payment was tendered plus interest to Brian Cave to cover their costs. They sent them back. There is a motion now pending before the Peoria court to put the check in the clerk's office and keep the money in the clerk's office because they refused to accept it. In addition, a check was sent to Jose for Jose to cover the judgment, and he refused, pursuant to the Brian Cave letter, to accept the judgment, and so I consider that to be jockeying for position with respect to the reopening of the case.
So on those rules, what happened in the state court after those rules?
When they filed the petition to come back and reopen the judgment before Judge McDade, they sent a notice of intention to abandon their petition to the state court. But as you know, in Illinois, you can't abandon something by mail. You have to go in front of a judge and move to discharge the rule. And there was no so both motions are still pending down there in Peoria, and everything is awaiting whatever decision comes here before in the state court, because the state court has actively got both of them before it and has jurisdiction, because Jose voluntarily walked in, agreed to entry of the judgment, was represented by counsel, the documents were signed by him, and contained in there is the statement that no third-party representations have been made to him to induce him to sign and enter into the judgment. So that can be found in the written judgment of the circuit court, that you have all the standard boilerplate, and the judgment was drafted by Brian Cave. In other words, the provisions of the agreement was drafted by Jose's counsel. So that's the source of that. With respect to your question, Judge Kaney, issue was very close in time. The immigration authorities made their decision on December the 7th of last year. The mail does not work at slight speed like our computers. So by the time that the materials got to our client, they had already moved for refiling the case. So there isn't the second lie that you just had to deal with.
Did Judge McDade make a finding as to that?
No, he didn't. But I just wanted to answer your question directly, because I can understand that would be a significant item in your thinking about this matter. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, who would be in their right mind would take children out of the country until they had their green card? Because immigration could detain them at the airport. They have no access to a lawyer. They have no ability to communicate with anybody. And so I think I've answered your particular question. Judge Posner, with respect to the questions that you grilled me on earlier, I would like to point out that if you read the second sentence in conjunction, there's no way you can read the first sentence without the second sentence. And the second sentence says, prior to July 1st, 2007, mother agrees to waive any statute of limitations, and the parties that agree that for purposes of the Hague proceeding, habitual residence shall be determined prior to the children's removal from Venezuela in March 2006. So any Hague matter starting after July or resuming or whatever word we want to use to reopen the judgment, after July 1st, 2007, habitual residence is the United States under the terms of that agreement.
Well, all it says is that that habitual residence shall be decided it shall be the habitual residence of the kids before they came to the United States. That's all it says there.
Well, but
before
you have
March
the second
2006.
Sentence. I respectfully submit to you, and I know you're one of the leaders in deciding Hague cases. I wish you'd come and speak to the convention one of these years, because we never see American judges when we meet in The Hague. For whatever reason, the U.S. courts don't send anybody. But you can't read the first sentence without the second sentence. The two of them are, you know, it's like reading a statute. You can't leave out one sentence without looking at the sentence that precedes it.
No, I understand that, but it seems to me the second sentence, the purpose of the second sentence is to make clear that their habitual residence, the place of habitual residence, is to be determined, or rather the relevant habitual residence is their habitual residence before March 2006, which is fine, but I don't see how that bears on the issue.
Well, the fact that Congress confirmed you, you're a better writer than I when it comes to legal issues, but prior to July 1st, 2007, and followed by a comma, that clearly sets forth the condition preceding, that it's effective prior to July 1st, 2007, and after July 1st, 2007, the other rule applies.
Ms. Comey, as you described the status and the pending status also of the past status and pending status of the state court actions, the rules, was that all laid out before Judge McDade?
Yes, sir. He was aware of it.
He was aware, even to the extent of the that you've laid out this morning,
Right. He asked questions about whether the father was behind in child support during the hearing. I mean, there was a real question about the father being behind in child support. And this is a father who had been flown to Miami at our client's expense, lived in Miami with the children for a substantial period of time, and had done it more than once. In other words, he got the benefits of the agreement. It's very unusual for a person to try to reopen a judgment once after accepting the benefits of the agreement. You know, and so he had accepted the benefits of the agreement, and we had even tried to pay them the judgment, and they declined to accept it. And now it's up to a circuit judge as to whether that money should go into the clerk's office and stay in the clerk's account.
So is it your position, or let me just ask the question, apart from the initial representation of why the mother was coming to the country, you're suggesting there were no misrepresentations?
I'm suggesting that that was an out-and-out lie in the first instance.
But that is the sum and substance of what you would say anybody could make a claim of fraud in this case.
Right, but you have two parallel events going on in this case. One parallel event was the fact that nobody will hire somebody without a green card. So she's stuck at the maid level. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? She doesn't have a green card. She didn't have a green card till December. So her financial ability was limited like every parent that ever came from the old world without a green card. Okay.
What about her husband, the new husband? What about the new husband?
The new husband's in the automotive business. You're familiar with General Motors stock. You probably read the Wall Street Journal. He's Chevrolet. Straight down. That occurred parallel to this. The sales, he works for a motor car company that sells Chevrolets in Peoria. And, you know, he had a good year before, but, you know, over time it doesn't always happen. We're more blessed in the legal profession that we're able to have more consistent years, but not everyone else is that blessing.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Comey.
And for having us in, and appreciate the opportunity to argue this to you, and I hope you guys will accept the invitation one of these days and come to The Hague and speak to the convention.
Oh, I'd love to go to The Hague. Sure, why not? Okay. So thank you, Mr. Marshall, also, and the case will be taken under advisement.